This is Space Time, Series 27, Episode 22, for broadcast on the 19th of February, 2024. Coming up on Space Time, technical issues hit NASA's Mars Perseverance rover. Was Snowball Earth caused by an asteroid impact winter? And the next generation NASA spacesuit now being tested in microgravity. All that and more coming up on Space Time.
Welcome to Space Time with Stuart Gary.
Mission managers and engineers are working to resolve a technical issue which is seriously affecting NASA's Mars Perseverance rover. They're trying to stabilize a dust cover on one of the CarSize vehicle's science instrument cameras. Data and imagery from Perseverance indicates that one of two covers designed to keep dust from accumulating on the optics of the Sherlock instrument remains partially open. In this position, the cover interferes with science data collection operations. Mounted on the rover's robotic arm, the scanning habitable environments with Raman and Luminescence for Organics and Chemicals instrument, better known as Sherlock, uses cameras, a spectrometer and a laser to search for organic compounds and minerals that have been altered by watery environments and may be signs of past microbial life on the Red Planet. Sherlock is NASA's main data collection instrument on Perseverance, which has been exploring Jezero Crater since February 2021. Last month, mission managers determined that the cover was oriented in such a position that some of its operations simply could not be successfully undertaken. Now, ever since then, an engineering team's been investigating to determine the root cause of the problem and search for a possible solution. To better understand the behavior of the cover's motor, the team have been sending commands to the instrument that alter the amount of power it's receiving. With the cover in its current position, the instrument cannot use its laser on rock targets, and so it can't collect spectroscopic data. However, imaging microscopy can still be done using the wide-angle topographic sensor for operations in engineering, better known as Watson. It's a color camera on Sherlock that's used for taking close-up images of rock grains and surface textures, and which operates using a different aperture. Currently making its way to explore an area known as Beehive Geyser, the six-wheeled robotic rover marked its 1,000th Martian day or sol on the Red Planet back in December. That's more than 300 sols beyond its primary mission. Since the rover's landing back on February 18, 2021, Sherlock scanned and provided rich data on 34 rock targets, creating a total of 261 hyperspectral maps of those samples. Perseverance uses a radioisotope power system. Its design's based on NASA's other currently operating rover on the Red Planet, the Mars Curiosity rover, which is still going strong after more than 11 years, or 4,000 sols, on the surface of Mars. This is Space Time. Still to come, was Snowball Earth caused by an asteroid impact winter? And we look at the astronomy of Britain's ancient standing stones. All that and more still to come on Space Time. A new study claims that snowball Earth events, which cover the planet in ice for thousands to millions of years, could have been triggered by an impact winter caused by a large asteroid strike. The findings, reported in the journal Science Advances, provides a new option for a question that's been stumping scientists for decades about these most dramatic climate shifts in Earth's history. Climate modelers have known since the 1960s that if the Earth became sufficiently cold, the high reflectivity of its snow and ice could create a runaway feedback loop. That would create more sea ice and even colder temperatures until eventually the planet would be completely covered in ice and snow. These very conditions are known to have occurred at least twice during Earth's Neoproterozoic era, between 720 and 635 million years ago. However, efforts to explain what initiated these periods of global glaciation, which have become known as snowball Earth events, have been inconclusive. Most theories have centered on the idea that greenhouse gases in the atmosphere somehow declined to the point where snowballing began. Another popular hypothesis involves changes in the Milankovitch cycles, which dictate the tilt of Earth's axis, and changes in the shape of Earth's orbit around the Sun. And yet another possibility involves changes in ocean currents and landmass heating caused by continental drift. This study's lead author, Min-Min Fu from Yale University, says they decided to explore an alternative possibility. What if an extraterrestrial impact caused this climate change transition very abruptly, what astronomers refer to as an impact winter? To work out what would happen, the authors used a sophisticated climate model which represents atmospheric and oceanic circulations as well as the formation of sea ice under different conditions. They then applied their model to the aftermath of a hypothetical asteroid impact in four distinct geological periods in the past. The pre-industrial period, before 150 years ago. The last glacial maximum, 21,000 years ago. The Cretaceous period, around 66 million years ago. And the Neoproterozoic epoch, between 1 billion and 542 million years ago. For two of the warmer climate scenarios, the Cretaceous and pre-industrial, the authors found that it was unlikely that an asteroid strike could trigger global glaciation. After all, we had one of those when the Chicxulub asteroid slammed into the Yucatan Peninsula. That ended more than 75% of all life on the planet, including all the non-avian dinosaurs. But for the last glacial minimum and neoproterozoic scenarios, when the Earth's temperature may have been cold enough already to be considered an ice age, an asteroid impact just might have been enough to tip the Earth into a snowball state. Surprisingly, they found that given sufficiently cold initial climate conditions, a snowball state after an asteroid impact could develop over a global ocean in just 10 years or so, with sea ice at the equator reaching 10 meters in thickness. Now, by comparison, the Arctic Ocean today averages sea ice thickness of between 1 and 3 metres. As for chances of an asteroid-induced snowball Earth period in the years to come, well, the authors say that's highly unlikely due to global warming. This is Space Time. Still to come, the astronomy behind ancient Britain's standing stones, and NASA testing their next-generation spacesuits for the International Space Station in microgravity. All that and more still to come on Space Time. All across Europe, including the British Isles, there are standing stones, ancient monuments dating back thousands of years. There's always been mystery associated with the likely origins of these. From Stonehenge to Orkney, these standing stones, which predate the pyramids, have been a source of wonder and speculation. Were they religious monuments or an astronomically linked agricultural calendar? Well, a few years ago, scientists at the University of Adelaide were able to statistically prove for the first time that the earliest standing stone monuments in Britain, the Great Circles, were constructed specifically in line with the movement of the Sun and Moon some 5,000 years ago. Their research, published in the Journal of Archaeological Science Reports, used innovative two- and three-dimensional technologies to construct quantitative tests of the patterns of the alignments of the standing stones. The study's lead author, Gail Higginbottom, who at the time was a visiting research fellow at both the Australian National University and the University of Adelaide, says nobody had statistically determined that a single stone circle was constructed with astronomical phenomena in mind prior to this research. In other words, up until then, it was all just speculation. So Higginbottom and colleagues examined the oldest great stone circles built in Scotland, Callanish on the Isle of Lewis and Stenness on the Isle of Orkney, both of which predate Stonehenge's standing stones by around 500 years. What they found was a great concentration of alignments towards both the Sun and the Moon at different times in their cycles. Now, it's important to remember that 2,000 years later in Scotland, much simpler monuments were still being built that had at least one of the same astronomical alignments found in the Great Circles. The stones, however, are not just connected with the Sun and the Moon. The authors also discovered a complex relationship between the alignment of the stones, the surrounding landscape and horizon, and the movements of the Sun and Moon across that landscape. Higginbottom says it was the final proof they needed that ancient Britons connected the Earth to the sky with their earliest standing stones, and that this practice continued in the same way for some 2,000 years. By examining sites in detail, the authors found that about half of the sites were surrounded by just one landscape pattern, and the other half of the sites were composed of the complete opposite. And these chosen surroundings would have influenced the way the sun and the moon were seen, especially in the timing of their rising and setting on special days, like when the moon appears at its most northerly position on the horizon, which only happens every 18.6 years. For example, at 50% of the sites, the northern horizon is relatively higher and closer than the southern horizon, and the summer solstice sun rises out of the highest peak in the north. And at the other 50% of the sites, it's the southern horizon which is higher and closer than the northern, and the winter solstice sun rises out of these highest horizons. Higginbottom says it appears the people of the day chose to erect these giant stone monuments very precisely within the landscape and in relation to the astronomy they knew. She says they invested a tremendous amount of effort and work to do so, which tells modern-day scientists about their strong connection with their environment and how important it must have been for them.
Most certainly, as far as individual statistical evidence for individual circles, as opposed to looking at groups of circles, for example, this is the first time that we've actually been able to confirm that individual circles have a complex array of orientations regarding different parts of the solar and lunar cycles. And part of the reason for that is that when people were looking at the stone circles previously, they used to look at just the orientations that they thought hit on the sun or the moon, and they ignored those that didn't. So even if they tried to do some kind of assessment on it, they weren't approaching it in a very fully sound manner. So now we can conclude that we've done that, and we've got excellent results where both the circle of Callanish, which is on the west coast and the Isle of Lewis of Scotland, and Orkney, the stone circle there, Stennis, most certainly, say 97.7% sure that they are set up in regards to astronomical phenomena.
And how did you do the research?
So we had two approaches. The first one was we had to do a very specific statistical test that was developed by my colleague Roger Clay. How much in depth would you like me to go into that? Couple of lines?
Yeah, well, we're dealing with something that was 5,000 years ago when these things were first set up. So obviously the sky was different then. You had to account for all that. And also the landscape, although the hills were there, nevertheless, the landscape may have appeared different in terms of vegetation and that sort of thing. All these environmental factors need to be considered as well. So what did you basically do?
Yes, so first, of course, we did run our programs to ensure that we knew exactly where the sun and the moon were rising and setting at the time that these stones have been shown to be erected, as scientific dating has shown for them to be erected. And then on top of that, we looked at or examined the possibility of the vegetation cover in the areas, and basically, certainly for Western Scotland, it was shown that there was either very, very open, kind of like a scrubland equivalent, and partial, very, very open, basically, particularly on Western Lewis. Very, very open, and Western Scotland generally, and on Orkney during that time, it would have been much the same. So when there were trees, it was very open, or sometimes just open patches in these two particular areas, and we've looked at other areas individually.
Is it difficult to put a date on these things? How does one date stone? You can't use carbon dating for stone, I guess, so you're looking at something which is buried somewhere near it, I guess. How did you do it?
Actually, I didn't do it, but other people. For example, a gentleman by the name of Patrick Ashmore did excavation of Callanish, and they looked at the different times that specific stones were erected or not, and other activities around the stone circle. So they confirmed that the different kinds of dating you do are through burnt material, so for example wood, or bone, and both have been found at Stennis and Callanish.
That gave scientists a pretty good idea of when these things were erected. I guess the fact that we're seeing these sorts of stone circles throughout what we now call the British Isles, but also we've seen them in parts of Europe as well. Are we looking at, and I know this isn't your specific area of expertise, but are we looking at something which was a fairly, literally a broad church, I guess, something that was practiced over a wide area?
Certainly standing stone monuments were placed over a wide area, right from Ireland until Eastern Europe and beyond, in fact, India, China, other places right through at slightly different times. Standing stone circles, though, are certainly not as prevalent as perhaps stone rows or single standing stones. And stone circles are most prevalent in the British Isles, Western Europe, Spain, Portugal, a few in Scandinavia, no confirmed circles in Germany, but lots of standing stones. The circles tend to be part of a burial monument as opposed to a separate standing stone circle. But there are great patches through the European continent where people chose to continue building their monuments in wood and earth. So there's a very interesting division there between the groups of people who adopted the megalithic culture and those who didn't.
Does it go with trade?
Interesting question. I think that in the very, very early days of when, for example, agriculture was first coming in through Europe, I think that that is a possibility. I think it would have been trade, but also the movement of peoples, because sometimes people brought this different and the new, this is called the Neolithic, sort of agriculture and the new Stone Age coming through parts of Europe, such as southeastern Europe and moving through central Europe. And other times it was trade. So it would have been a combination. Nothing simple, I'm afraid. Sorry, I'd like to say it was simple, but it's not.
Seldom
is, particularly unfortunately. Yeah, exactly. We like to try and keep it simple, but then reality overtakes us.
Yeah, there's always caveats in any sort of research.
Absolutely, I agree with you fully there.
What got you interested in this?
What got me most interested in it was when I first saw a very tiny, tiny article in Scientific American many years ago on the standing stones of Scotland, or one in particular. And my colleague said to me, why don't you do this for your PhD? Maybe you could really solve some of the issues. So it all began there. And I have been addicted to it ever since, moving through from monument to monument and place to place across Scotland and branching out now through the British Isles and parts of Europe to see whether or not how much there is a connection between the peoples and culturally of those who are using standing stones.
There's been a lot of work in Australia looking at Aboriginal astronomy and the role that the night skies play in Aboriginal culture. And one thing I've seen by looking at that is that it simply mirrors what's happening everywhere else in the world. Is that what you're seeing?
If you're certainly referring to the idea that people were closely wedded to the night sky and the day sky as well, I would say absolutely. That the sky itself, you know, in different ways, of course, because the Indigenous people of Australia often looked at the dark spaces in between the bright white light, so to speak, and they had their shapes and their dream time connected to these identities, and they then mirrored what happened to them in their dream time on Earth as well. And overseas, ethnographically, you have very similar models, but with constellations. And I think that in ancient times that people were very closely, or prehistoric times, were very, very closely connected to their landscape. They had to be, because it was a life and death situation and it was their full-time living space. You pay attention to what's going on if you're living in it.
Is it just for agricultural purposes, or is there more to it than that? All we really have are the stones. There's no written work associated with this. What do you surmise from what you've done?
I think there are two very important things going on. They're both tightly entwined, and that is, I think that the standing stones are in places that people already knew about, but at these places, and I'll explain this because it's something that we haven't really touched on, is that the standing stones in Britain at least are in very specific places we've discovered, which allow you to view the sun and the moon from very specific perspectives. So for instance, you can at half the site see one perspective and, you know, loosely speaking, and at the other half of the site's another perspective. And so the first perspective is that when you're standing at your stone circle, that you will have the northern horizon very high and quite close to you relatively. The south will be very distant and low compared to the north. The summer solstice sun will rise out of the highest peak in the northeast out of this range or hillock or mountain, depending on the landscape, and set in the high mountain in the northwest. If you turn south, the winter solstice sun will rise and set out of little hills, or they could be mountains at a great distance, from the southeast and set into a hill in the southwest. And often it will travel over water to do so. And so you have all these amazing setups that they've done that can only be viewed at these specific locations. And what we discovered that for scores of sites in Western Scotland, which are Bronze Age, about 1500 BC, so that's about 3,500 2,000 years ago, and we now know those two great circles we talked about at the beginning have the same setup. And so, to get back to your question, therefore, they know about these places already, so I don't think that they're already agricultural, because as soon as they built standing stones, they already knew about those places before agriculture had come. Agriculture was coming into that area around the same time. They were mainly herders, but they did do some agriculture, but it wasn't as big as it was down south, so to speak. I think that what they've done is actually represent their cosmological understanding of the universe, and through these standing stones and how they see the sunrise and set out of those very special setups that they've done, they're showing themselves, and it represents the cycle that they understand that the universe works as a cycle, and that there is a cycle themselves work as opposition. So you've got day and night, the sun rising in the north, for example, at summer solstice, the full moon that can only rise in the south at the summer solstice if it's at its most extreme rising and setting point, which only occurs every 18.6 years, and all these kind of complicated things go on. Enough information, in fact, that they could even, if they wanted to, predict eclipses if they knew about that sort of thing. So there's more to it than just the Neolithic.
Yeah, it's a very detailed culture, isn't it?
It is very detailed and very complex. And it's also linked to the cult of the dead, because you will always find the dead associated with standing stones.
Oh, that was my next question. Are there burial sites nearby? So I guess you've just answered that.
Yes, and in very, very different ways. When they're associated directly with the standing stones, they're very frequently cremated dead. And you get parts of people's bodies placed, cremated bones, that is, placed in the socket of the standing stones. So they put them in before they put the people in, or parts of them, before they put the standing stone there. And then they may also put a cremated burial inside a jar and bury that next to the standing stone. Or it may in fact be next to where they bury the cremation in a stone slab coffin underneath the ground and put a nice stone monument over that, you know, a cairn, we call it.
Yep.
So the dead are associated in many different ways with these standing stones, and Stonehenge itself is known to have many, many dead associated with it.
With some standing stones, I believe there's also evidence of festivals associated with that, animal bones, things like that.
Oh, yes, we've got something very similar also happened at Stennis. So certainly nearby there may have actually been major festivals occurring, whether that's in association with the dead or not as well, I'm unsure, but they've also found bones that are associated with specific seasons in relation to the areas near Stonehenge. And they've decided they may well have been the special gathering times that people met together for either trade or other kinds of connections between groups across a large area.
That's Gail Higginbottom, who at the time of our interview was a visiting research fellow with the University of Adelaide and the Australian National University. This is Space Time. Still to come, NASA tests its next-generation international spacesuits in microgravity, and later in the science report, a new study has found nearly half of all the world's migratory species are now experiencing a population decline. All that and more still to come on Space Time. Well, NASA's new spacesuits for use on the Artemis program on the lunar surface are still being developed and are now years behind schedule and over budget. Another spacesuit project, this one for use aboard the International Space Station, has now finally reached the testing phase. The new extravehicular activity, or EVA, spacesuits are being developed by Raytheon's Collins Aerospace. Now, the first completed pressure garment has undergone a system of fit and functionality tests in the microgravity-like environment of a Vomit Comet aircraft. These converted jetliners achieve microgravity-like conditions by undertaking a series of steep parabolic roller coaster-like maneuvers in flight. The test is part of NASA's rigorous preliminary design review process, ensuring the new spacesuits meet all necessary system requirements before the commencement of manufacturing actual flight-ready suits. The new suits will eventually replace the current spacesuits used aboard the International Space Station, which are known as the Extravehicular Mobility Unit, or EMU. The EMU's been the standard for astronauts tasked with assembling and maintaining the space station for over two decades, and were originally developed for the space shuttle era. As for these new suits, they'll feature updated technologies and materials, enhanced functionality, improved safety measures, and better support for an extended range of operations during spacewalks. This is Space Time. And time now to take a brief look at some of the other stories making news in science this week with the Science Report. A new landmark study has warned that nearly half of the world's migratory species are showing population decline. The findings are contained in the first ever report on the state of the world's migratory species by the Convention on the Conservation of Migratory Species of Wild Animals. The report, which was partially funded by the Australian government, found more than one in five listed species are threatened with extinction, while nearly all, some 97% of listed fish, are also threatened with extinction. Climate change, pollution, and invasive species are all having a profound impact on migratory animals. But the study points out that the two greatest threats are overexploitation by humans and habitat loss, also due to human activity. New researchers found that the magma flow into the dike beneath the Icelandic town of Grindavik in November was moving at an unprecedented 7,400 cubic metres per second. A report of the journal Science claims the resulting lava flow caused widespread damage. Vertical magma dikes are a pathway often formed from tectonic fracturing for subsurface molten rocks to move rapidly upwards. According to the study's authors, these findings have serious implications for hazard mitigation should the magma build up in the dikes breach the surface and produce an eruption. The ancient Finke River, which flows south of the central Australian town of Alice Springs, is often described as one of the world's oldest rivers. Now, a new study in the journal Vertebrate Paleontology has shown how the waterway was once teeming with bizarre animal life. And included in that was a sleek predatory lobe fin fish with large fangs and bony scales. The newly described air-breathing fish dates back more than 380 million years and has been named Harrogycodectes zoomini. The Green Hills of Wales are not normally thought of as Sasquatch country, but reports of recent Bigfoot sightings in the area have been spreading far and wide. However, as Tim Mendham from Australian Skeptics points out, those behind the sightings just happen to be a TV crew, and they just may have ulterior motives.
Always love a good Bigfoot story. The week is not complete without a Bigfoot story. But unusually, that you would normally associate Big Feet with the US, and practically every state in the US has a Bigfoot or two.
It was Bigfoots, not Big Feet.
Well, I don't know. Bigfoots, but every state in America has one. Even Florida's got one. Texas has got one. It's not always in the Northwest Pacific areas. But Wales has one in the UK. And Wales is not necessarily known for Bigfoots, more known for rugby players and sheep and that sort of stuff. But there was a story people discovered rather large footprints, size 23 it was described as, and a nest, which is basically like a little shelter made up of twigs and branches and stuff. Wouldn't be much defence against the rain, which Wales is also known for. But they were saying, look, here we are, we have this evidence of a Bigfoot, which, as they all described, with feet about the same size as the Shaq, Shaquille O'Neal, the basketball player, which I think is a bit rough on Shaquille O'Neal. I don't think he's a Bigfoot. He has big feet. But anyway, everyone was describing that to give you an idea of how big these footprints were. And they found this lair made out of sticks, etc. And it was found by, intriguingly, by paranormal researchers and filmmakers working on a new TV series.
About what? He asks innocently.
Perhaps they were researching Bigfoots. And lo and behold, they found one. Well, they found the evidence for one.
I'm beside myself with shock.
I know. If only it would work out that way all the time. But it's got publicity. It went around the world, etc. And people were very intrigued by Bigfoot in Wales, as it would be, until suddenly a couple of days later, someone came out and said, oh, it's a hoax. And sort of blow me down with a feather. Someone said, we actually did it, but I presume it's the same filmmakers owning up that they faked the stories. They built this little fairly rubbishy shelter and they imprinted these Shaquille O'Neal-sized footprints and they said, it was us all the time. Surprise. I think you should have left it a bit longer before revealing the hoax, unless the people revealing the hoax are actually a hoax themselves.
Well, that's what they'd want you to think, isn't it?
That's what they want you to think. But actually, the debunking, as always the case, didn't get as much publicity as the original claim. Debunking never does. The sceptics burden. The sceptics have to carry that. The original outlandish claim gets front page news. The debunking gets back page news, if at all. The truth is not an interest. The claim is a lot better, a lot more fun. I can perhaps understand that, but still.
That's Tim Mendham from Australian Sceptics. That's the show for now. Spacetime is available every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday through Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Spotify, Acast, Amazon Music, Bytes.com, SoundCloud, YouTube, your favorite podcast download provider, and from spacetimewithstuartgarry.com. Spacetime's also broadcast through the National Science Foundation on Science Zone Radio and on both iHeartRadio and TuneIn Radio. And you can help to support our show by visiting the Spacetime store for a range of promotional merchandising goodies, or by becoming a Spacetime patron, which gives you access to triple episode commercial-free versions of the show, as well as lots of bonus audio content which doesn't go to air, access to our exclusive Facebook group, and other rewards. Just go to spacetimewithstuartgarry.com for full details. And if you want more Space Time, please check out our blog, where you'll find all the stuff we couldn't fit in the show, as well as heaps of images, news stories, loads of videos, and things on the web I find interesting or amusing. Just go to spacetimewithstuartgarry.tumblr.com. That's all one word, and that's Tumblr without the E. You can also follow us through @StuartGarry on Twitter, @SpaceTimeWithStuartGarry on Instagram, through our Spacetime YouTube channel, and on Facebook, just go to facebook.com/SpaceTimeWithStuartGarry.
You've been listening to Spacetime with Stuart Garry. This has been another quality podcast production from Bytes.com.